Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Imagine, you studied chemistry in college and then got a law degree. After that, you went to Harvard for a degree in city planning. Out of school, you worked for almost 8 years in Washington, D.C. as chief of staff for United States Senator Max Baucus. Back in Montana, you were founding partner of what would become one of the state's most prominent law firms. And across much of that time, you've been heavily engaged in community service, from Helena's Murnaloy Center and the Montana Community Foundation to the American Indian Institute. Imagine, you're Steve Browning. Steve, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana. My father was a physician. My mother was a homemaker.
When you look back on your childhood, what key values did you learn, would you say?
I don't think I really developed my key values until I was an adolescent. I learned a lot of things from my stepmother. My mother was alcoholic and unfortunately endured the problems of alcoholism, which
I have really experienced those with a close family member.
I think probably most of your listeners have as well.
Sure.
Particularly true in the 30s and 40s.
So your stepmom.
Yeah, my stepmother, who was a nurse, my parents were divorced. I always had to look after my mother, really until she died. For about 25 years, I had to look after her. Hmm. But my stepmother came into the scene, a very stern woman, someone I didn't like very much in the early years. I grew up in Indianapolis. I was born in 1940. And these were in the 50s.
So she came in when you were a teenager?
When I was a teenager. In any event, some of the things that I learned from her, I remember so well one time that she and my father had been approached at their church about donating an organ to the church. And she said to my father, "Jim, we can afford to give that organ, but the church really won't fully appreciate it unless we ask them to participate in it with us. So let's just give them half of the price for the organ, and they can raise the other half. Then we can take the half that we saved, and we can give it to something else along the same lines." I didn't at the moment understand really what she was talking about. But as years passed, I really now understand you need to get all the people involved if they're going to really appreciate what they have. It doesn't make any difference if it's a charity or working with a child. My wife and I didn't have children. So I can really sound very pontifical about raising kids. But the key thing, it seems to me, about raising kids is you have to make sure that they appreciate what it is that the parents are doing for them. And not take, 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 but they have to give, give, give as well.
I've mentioned you got a degree in chemistry. Where'd you go to school?
I went to school at Indiana University.
And law school?
Also Indiana University. I only studied chemistry because I was in pre-med, and I got accepted to medical school. I had to pay my matriculation fee of $200. I was just about ready to enter medical school, and I started obsessing about cutting up a cadaver. And I thought, you know, I'm not sure I can really do this. I wanted to be a psychiatrist. So I called the medical school, and I asked them if the matriculation fee was refundable. And they said, "Oh, no, no, that's not refundable." I thought, "Oh, okay, I'll call you back." And I thought about it for another week or so, and I decided, you know, I can't do it. I can't cut up a body. So I called them and said, "I'm sorry, but you're going to have to give that position to someone else." And so I went back to school, and that in those days, pre-med was 3 years. And so I had to declare for a degree. And the only degree I could get in 1 year was chemistry because I'd taken so much pre-med. I really didn't like chemistry very much. I much preferred literature and history and political science.
Why law?
Law just seemed like an interesting field to me. I didn't take law to become a lawyer. I thought it would be just an interesting opportunity to study more and learn about the world. And it was really very valuable to me in that sense. When I left law school, I really had no expectation of being a lawyer. I didn't know what I was going to do. Here I am, almost 74 years old. I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do.
Why city planning at Harvard after law? That's unorthodox.
Well, it was. I worked for 2 years in New York City for a pharmaceutical company. And in those days, I think I was really more absorbed with myself and not enough with what was going on around me. And it really wasn't until I was walking back from work one day. We lived right by Lincoln Center. And a fairly grubby young man came up to me and started talking to me. And I always like people, and I'm engaged by almost anyone. And as the more I talked to him, the more I was interested in what he was doing. And I found out he was a VISTA volunteer working with the community. And as I listened to what he felt challenged about, I began to feel challenged as well.
Really? Now, this is the 60s?
Yes, it was by 1967.
Okay.
I graduated from law school in 66. And as I thought more of that conversation and what was going on around me with the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, things that I was reading in the newspaper but wasn't really engaged by yet. There were a lot of people my age that were freedom riders that would go to the South. That never even occurred to me to do that. But as I contemplated that conversation, I decided I really needed to study more. And I went to the New York City Public Library, and I went into these catalogs of colleges and graduate schools. And I thought, maybe I'll get a degree in sociology. Now, I want me to say this. I didn't have any student debt. My parents didn't pay for my school. After I finished my freshman year, from that point on, I was always able to work and pay for the expenses of school. And I felt if I did that, it meant more to me. That was, again, part of the training from my stepmother. In any event, I decided to look at these catalogs, and the one catalog that caught my eye was city planning. It seemed to have a lot of the elements that I had thought about with the VISTA volunteer and other things. So I applied to two schools, Harvard and Berkeley, and I was accepted to Harvard. I never heard back from Berkeley, as I recall. Or if I did, it was a year or so after I'd already gone to school. But anyway, that's how I picked city planning.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Steve Browning, attorney and a citizen. So was city planning what you expected in terms of what you learned?
Actually, it was. It was a three-year program, which I was able to condense to 2 years. And essentially, Harvard allowed me to create my own curriculum. I went and had a lot of interesting professors to MIT, the law school, and the like, and I just learned a lot about how cities work.
Why did that relate to the VISTA experience, how cities work?
It made a difference because it taught me that there are public policies that affect the way people live. People don't live in a vacuum in cities. There are public policies that affect them, whether they are federal, state, or urban policies, policies by corporations. And I learned how all those forces work together to impact people's lives, both positively and negatively. For example, what can cities do to either help or hinder the opportunities for people to have decent housing? And the answer oftentimes is the wrong answer, I think, when we, for example, went to public housing. Instead, we did much better with providing financial support to families to assist them in their housing needs, and also to look to the private sector to come forward with better ways of meeting people's housing needs.
You then move on to what I will call political policy staff work, mainly for Max Baucus. First when he's in Congress and then when he's in the Senate. That sounds like a fair bridge from your city planning. Was it? What was that experience like? Because you were involved in public policy.
Yes. Actually, there was an interim period between the time that I spent 5 years as a civil rights lawyer. I then worked for a year for Ed Muskie doing education, manpower, and social services, all of which are public policies relating to government, cities, people. And when I worked for Muskie, I was engaged with these broader policy issues. But the fact is, I was really much more interested in getting down and working with people, not with budget numbers,
okay,
but with people. And at that point, I was approached by then Congressman Baucus to run his office in Washington, D.C. So I left Senator Muskie, went to work with Congressman Max Baucus, and began working in Montana with people.
How was that experience looking back? That's a big chunk of time in public policy / politics working for the public sector.
I oftentimes told people that working for Congress in those days, and probably still the case, is like trying to take a drink out of a fire hydrant. I mean, there is so much stuff coming at you all the time. It's a very draining job. Starts at 7 o'clock in the morning and sometimes doesn't until 9 o'clock at night. Everybody wants something. Everybody's either mad about something or needs help on something. And so it was really working out the priorities and then working with the staff. We always had quite a few staff members and had to make sure that they were all fully engaged.
Looking back, do you feel it was worthwhile? What did you learn that you didn't know?
Oh, yes, it was definitely worthwhile. What did I learn that I didn't know? I learned, I think, that I had leadership qualities that I wasn't really that conscious of and became a really engaged in managing people, both people in the office and other people that I was dealing with outside the office.
You say leadership qualities. What does that mean in concrete terms?
In concrete terms, as I reflect back on it, it's the kind of things that you learn when you're a kid, when you're out playing. Some kids take charge. And I was always one of those kids that took charge. It didn't make any difference what we were doing. As a group of kids, I would say to kids, let's do this, and they would do it. A lot of kids will just hold back. They're not really sure what to do, or if they try to take charge, people don't follow them. And there was something that I did that at least people said, oh, that kid knows what he's doing. I think I'll do what he is suggesting.
All right, that's the playground. What are the leadership qualities that worked for you as a staff member to United States Senator?
Some of the things that I can reflect on. One of the things, I've always liked people. I networked throughout the halls of the House when I worked in the House and the Senate when I worked in the Senate. I basically ended up knowing everyone that was in a leadership position. I made it a point to arrange for a lunch with every chief of staff in the Senate. And I did that systematically, like one a week. And in 50 weeks, you've met half of the Senate leaders. There was always some turnover. And so that's what I would do.
So that sounds like knowing people is a key ingredient to leadership. But I want to push this a little bit because simply knowing people doesn't seem to me to generate into being able to influence their behavior.
Yeah, and I think that you can know people, and that is part of it, but they have to know you and like you and respect you. So when I finished meeting with people, I knew that they had an appreciation for what I'm about. I would do things to help them, then they would do things to help me.
We unfortunately only have half an hour because you have a very interesting and diverse resume.
Sure.
After Max, this is from your resume.
Mm-hmm.
You're actively involved in the practice of law with principal areas of practice including lobbying, legislative services, banking and financial institutions, healthcare and hospital law. If we had 8 hours, we could cover all of those. And your resume shows significant results, for example, in banking legislation affecting mm-hmm. Montana banking institutions, for one that comes to mind.
Sure.
How was that experience? What made you an effective lobbyist?
Well, most people sort of have disdain for lobbyists. We have a constitutional right to petition the government. Government makes decisions that affect people's lives. I represented a number of entities over the years where we tried to change the law to make it better for, in their case, their interests. Those are special interests. In this case, banks wanted to be able to have a greater opportunity to expand, to build different locations, to buy and other banks, to merge, to consolidate, to provide some efficiencies in their operations.
And you were successful, according to your resume, in getting some of that legislation passed.
Yes.
Okay. So how was the experience? What was key to your success? getting to know people? Was it the fact that you knew Max Baucus and he's on the finance committee and you were able to, I assume there are some connections there? What's the secret that you, to your success?
Actually, all of my work on banking was with the state legislature. It had nothing to do with Max Baucus. In terms of the elements of the success, it was simply working with legislators, working with bankers throughout the state, and making sure that they got their message across as to why this was good public policy to make these changes. And since those laws were modified, you know, Montana's banking system is much stronger. It's a very vibrant economy we have, at least with our banking system.
You started by saying there's disdain for lobbyists. Why do you think that is in the public perception?
I think that they think it's there's something untoward about lobbying. And the fact is that everyone is a special interest of some sort. When you look in your wallet, you'll see, you know, you have membership cards for different organizations, and each one of those is a special interest. And each one of those special interests is represented by somebody at the state legislature or in Congress.
I interviewed Conrad Burns last year. One of the questions I asked him was both between 2001 and 2006, if I remember the dates, both he and Max separately, two different political parties, raised $9.3 million each. That money came from interests that could afford to pay for it. They were banking, law, real estate, an array of issues, lobbyists, and one could, these are categories, larger categories, $350,000, $400,000. I asked him, what do people get for those contributions? Those are investments from business interests. He said access. Didn't hesitate a second. Someone might say that while it's obviously perfectly legal to redress the government for petition of grievances, I think that's something close to the phrase in the First Amendment, that it's a stacked deck, that moneyed interests have more influence over, let's say, Congress, let's leave off the Montana legislature, than people that aren't organized and don't have a lot of money. Would you agree or disagree with that perception?
I would agree with it completely.
How big a problem?
Well, I think it's a part of a problem we have. How big a part? A very significant part. I personally think we should have public financing of congressional races, and that would eliminate some of the advantages incumbents have. Is that all of the problem? Not really. I think that my judgment is that we have an underlying problem in the way our government is structured. We are the only democratic society, democratic government in the world that has the very split form of government we have. Our founders of the Constitution were very concerned about monopoly power in the monarchy, and they wanted to divide government up as much they could. And I think if James Madison and Jefferson and Monroe and others, Jay, were here at this time to see what they have come up with, they wouldn't like what we have right now. The gridlock we have in Washington, D.C. now is largely a result of all these divided powers. When you look at almost every other government in the world that is a free democratic society, they're all parliamentary governors. They fuse the executive with the legislative, and that would significantly help us move important pieces of legislation. Legislation doesn't move anymore in Washington, D.C. It only happens because of the budget cycle. So that's where I think the real problem is and what the solutions are.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Steve Browning, longtime attorney and citizen of Montana. Earlier you described your encounter with the Vista volunteer and that striking something in you that led to some sort of reexamination, let's say. You have an extensive career in community service and civic affairs. Let's talk about, looking back on that, what stands out to you, either specific causes? Let's start with specific causes that have been meaningful to you.
First, when I moved from Washington, D.C. to Helena in 1982, Washington, D.C. was a huge place. And it was very difficult to feel like you're really making an impact on people's lives directly. But when I came to Helena, people would come to me and said, Steve, we need help for this committee or this organization or to raise money for this cause. And I immediately accepted those challenges. One of the ones that I enjoyed very much doing in the early days was meeting with Arnie Molina. And Arnie had the idea of taking the jail and moving Second Story Cinema into the Lewis and Clark County Jail. And that those were the seeds of the Myrna Loy Center.
Now, and that, just in case people don't remember, outside Helena, the jail is a historic stone building. It was the jail at that time?
Yeah, it was the jail. It was a beautiful old Romanesque granite building. It was a county jail. They had to abandon it because of a lawsuit and build a new jail. So we were given the opportunity to occupy the old jail and convert it into a theater.
Why did that appeal to you?
Part of it was I love Second Story Cinema and the work that Arnie had done in bringing great performances to Helena. And it was a challenge. We had to raise initially $800,000 to make that conversion. In the end, it because of the old structure and things that weren't adequately anticipated, it cost $1.4 million to build that theater.
Fair amount of money in a town like ours.
Yes.
You were directly involved, is it fair to say, in fundraising?
Yes, I was the chairman of the board, and I was the chairman of the fundraising committee.
And what would you say was the, I asked you before about the ingredients of leadership, what are the key ingredients to get people to open their wallet and give money?
First of all, you had to know who to contact. To raise $1.4 million, we could get a dollar from everyone, and that would require 1.4 million people, which is double what we have here in Montana. So it was important that we maybe try to get $500,000 from one person, then $2 from 500,000 people. And so what I did with that, well, now who has the money? Who can we contact? How can we make the pitch to them that this is something good for the community? And in the end, we raised the $1.4 million. I will say this, so Brian, at one point in the process, which we're probably about two-thirds of the way through, I said to the board, we have to do more than just raise the $1.4 million. We also have to raise an endowment to support this organization in those times where it needs help.
An endowment is a fund that's set aside and generates interest over time. Is that sort of the idea?
Yes. Endowment is a fund that's a permanent fund. Can't be drawn upon except taking the earnings. So what we did, I said to the group, we need to raise an endowment. And in the end, people never responded to it. So I went to one board meeting after the third time I raised, and I said, I've created an endowment. And the people said, well, that's great. We're glad we have an endowment now. And one of the board members said, Steve, how much is in our endowment? And I said, $50. And they said, $50, that's all you had put in it? I said, hey, how much did you put in the endowment? And at that point, we raised, I passed the hat around. It was literally a hat. And people put in cash and checks, and we finished the evening. We had $1,100. Now, that endowment is now worth $1 million because we've added to it, and it's supported Myrna Loy in times of need.
Let me just read part of the list of things you've been involved with in a leadership role. Development Corporation of Montana, Keep Montana Clean and Beautiful, Montana Constitutional Connections Committee, Montana Committee on the United States Constitution, Northwest Policy Center's Leadership Council, Helena YMCA, Helena Kiwanis, Deaconess Research Institute, Myrna Loy, St. Peter's Community Hospital, Carroll College Foundation, and others. One that stands out is the Montana Community Foundation. Can you tell us about what that is, how it works, what it means?
Sure. The Montana Community Foundation is an organization that was created in 1990, and its sole purpose is to serve as the savings bank, as it were, for the people of Montana. It's a non-governmental organization. It provides contributions and grants to all kinds of worthy causes. When we started the Montana Community Foundation in 1990. It had a $250,000 endowment. Its endowment now is about $50 million or more. People start leaving their estates, parts of their estates, to the Community Foundation to support worthy causes. It's interesting, Brian, that all Americans are charitable. Invariably, if you've got a few extra bucks, you'll help out worthy causes. People give money to the United Way and all kinds of worthy causes, to their church and other things.
Sure.
But when people plan their estates, they almost never leave money to worthy causes. They just leave it to their family. And sure, their families are needy, but it's really important that we support our communities. And so my objective in working on the Montana Community Foundation was to create incentives so that people would leave more of their estates to organizations like the Montana Community Foundation.
You played a critical role, did you not, in getting the tax laws changed so there was now in Montana a major incentive to do just that?
Yes, and it's a tax credit that was adopted in 1987. It's been in place now for almost 17 years, and it provides a 40% tax credit for people who leave money or give money right now for planned gifts to support permanent endowments of charities in Montana.
And tax credit means straight off the tax, dollar for dollar. It's not like a deduction where you get a percentage.
That's correct. That's correct. So in this case, if I were to give a $5,000 to the Montana Community Foundation for planned gift, I could get the income from that for my life, but I also get the advantage of a 40% tax credit for Montana state taxes, and I get the tax deduction for the federal taxes. So a $5,000 gift really might only cost me $1,500 out of my own pocket.
You described a typically self-absorbed teenager. The man sitting in this room in his 70s has spent years working on helping other people. Why? Why do you do it?
I wish I could answer that in a way. I think it's just inside me right now. It fulfills me to work on projects that help other people. I don't do it out of guilt. I do it because there are needs, and I like to address needs in people. That's that simple.
Steve Browning, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground and for your service to our community. To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.